Hey, good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. And joining me today is Jeff Berner, who's a colleague of mine in the cybersecurity space, and he hails from Florida. And Jeff contacted me about this CrowdStrike thing just to get my opinion. We had one heck of a good conversation about it. And so I said, wow, you know, considering the impact that this has made, I figured it would be good to have as a discussion and share it with a wider audience. And before we get started on that, I want to comment that I saw plenty of people writing articles about CrowdStrike. And the thing that I found was that nobody has yet written an article about the stuff associated with CrowdStrike, talking about really two key elements. One was around the fact that CrowdStrike just wasn't a trustworthy counterparty to begin with. So we can talk about that. The second one really had to do with the legal defensibility of delayed security updates. But there, so let's talk about that in more detail. So, you know, Jeff, do you want to start us off with a little bit about you and then, you know, hover into like some questions for me about CrowdStrike?
Absolutely. And thank you for the introduction and having me on your podcast. No, my name is Jeff Berner. I am the CEO of IT Consulting St. Petersburg, recently certified as a virtual chief information security officer. And what I've learned in the short time that in the 6 or 7 years that I've been researching cybersecurity and information security, is that it's a daily learning experience. And one of the ways that I learn the best is asking colleagues, asking those who I believe have more information and getting their opinions on certain subjects that allow me to learn and grow myself. So thank you very much for the camaraderie, the collaboration, the discussions that we've had. And when it came to CrowdStrike, one of the things that I had first asked you was, how could this have been prevented from just in the realms of Delta Airlines? Because, you know, here we are 5-6 days into this thing, and there are news reports everywhere about luggage being here and not being able to reach pilots and flight attendants. And I looked at it from a security standpoint of, wait a minute, wouldn't Delta, you know, test this update, you know, prior to deploying it? But in my head, I thought, you know, well, if there's anyone who I'm going to trust, it's going to be my cybersecurity vendor with the reputation of CrowdStrike. And that's kind of where you led into, no, Jeff, that's not the way I would have a third-party security vendor, you know, rely on me to do their testing. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because I thought it was extremely interesting to hear your opinion as far as the trustability of your upstream vendor when it comes to security, or anyone else for that matter.
No, thank you for that. Yes, I will absolutely answer that question. And I think that this matter elucidates the necessity of having a ridiculously experienced technology executive at your fingertips, you know, which is what I think most organizations lack, because you can't just get the details that you need by, you know, reading bleeping computer every day. You know, right. It just doesn't work that way. You know, so I think a lot of people thought this concept of the testing the updates before they get deployed, and they're like, oh, well, this would have avoided the entire thing. And that's true to the degree that the company testing the updates is actually the software vendor themselves. Where I think the distinction has to be made is that it's not only not reasonable for a customer. So I'm going to call a customer as an end user, or the IT department of the customer is the end user of that software. It's not only not reasonable for them to be doing like test deployments, but it also isn't legally defensible. So I think that's the piece that like nobody's really talking about. So whenever you're picking a software package, or you're picking a paradigm or a strategy, like this is going to be our process, there's always this push to try to balance high security and operational functionality with low total cost of ownership, right? So if you're going to have really high security and you're going to have high operational functionality, there's a lot of babysitting involved in that. But yet they want low total cost of ownership. So part of the theory is, okay, well, where can we get our economies of scale? Theoretically, you would expect that the software manufacturer themselves would have the capabilities to have that economies of scale. Like, it would be basically a simple thing for them to be able to have a test lab and then to have their own internal team where it's their own internal employees doing that testing. And in fact, that is the exact process that WatchGuard uses. One of the things that I saw that was really interesting that came out of this whole debacle was that a number of software companies literally said, hey, this is our process. And in all these years, WatchGuard, which now owns Panda Security, and certainly now the WatchGuard team, has been doing that sort of staged deployment, which is completely economical for the software vendor to do. It is not economical at all for the end user of the software to do. And if you're like the IT manager, IT director, the CISO for Delta Airlines, for example, and then if you decided, oh, well, we're going to delay the deployment of that update of our business critical endpoint protection platform, and then the delay of that update, the deployment of that, is the thing that actually leads to a breach, That's not a legally defensible approach, right? In fact, you could make it, the insurance company could make an argument that says you didn't deploy this update in a timely fashion, so therefore we're going to now deny your insurance coverage. And there's something really important that people need to understand when it comes to technologies that provide security, whether you're talking about endpoint protection, web content filtering, whatever. It's technologies that deliver security filtration of some shape, size, or flavor. There's two main categories of that type of stuff. It's the stuff that updates once an hour, and it's the stuff that updates real time. Okay, so it's important to understand that those two categories, it updates in real time, it updates once an hour, neither one of those are conducive to a scenario that says I'm going to have a delayed update schedule, right? That's kind of like, we want the security protections as quickly as that data is available. I mean, the entire concept of like SOC and MDR and XDR and all of those things is this entire concept that says we're going to take intel that we see over here in this one little area and extrapolate that into protections across a much wider audience, whether that's inside the same company or if a company is leveraging the security technologies from an upstream vendor who is aggregating all of that live intel data. And in fact, that is one of the big pieces that Microsoft uses as their argumentation for why they think everybody should use Windows Defender. And their argument is that, well, we have all of this, you know, live real-time data from, you know, millions of endpoints around the entire world. So that's why people should use Microsoft, you know, Defender. Is because it has that ability to share the intel, the data feed for that security intelligence, which frankly, they all work that way. So that's where that bifurcation has to exist, where the software vendor, they can do the delayed testing and the delayed deployment and be okie dokie. And in fact, they need to, because they're the only ones that can economically do it due to the economies of scale. But the end customer, they legally should not be doing that.
Well, let me respond to that. And let me, maybe a couple of follow-up questions, because it seems to me that the director of IT or the CTO or the CISO at Delta is probably, I think there's a likelihood that the finger's being pointed at them to say, how could you not test? I would assume that, just from my experience alone, that when it comes to the functionality of a business, and when technology is interfering with revenue and profit, and the report I read this morning was it's up to $5.8 billion in losses worldwide, which is a staggering number.
And I'm sure you know this already, but that the customer agreement with CrowdStrike is that CrowdStrike can't be held liable for any of that.
Of course it is. Of course, I mean, yeah, I mean, we're laughing, but we both know that is, you know, very common, right? Because it's, of course, they're not going to be held liable, but this is not a cybersecurity attack. But at the same time,
it sure as hell was a denial of service attack, wasn't it?
Right. It sure it shows the world what technology can do. And, you know, even if it was just a human error. Now, you had mentioned.
Well, so it was denial of service in that it was a denial of service from what people had mistakenly made the decision was a trustworthy counterparty. When I knew years ago, CrowdStrike was not a trustworthy counterparty. And we'll circle back to that point.
Okay. Yeah, I would like you to. But now we have a company like CrowdStrike who, like you said, it's feasible, economically feasible for them to do the testing. Yet,
well,
I even read they test and test and test. But if that were the case, how in the
world
could this have happened?
So, okay. So, I mean, like, let's just take this from like an IT service provider perspective. If I was going to, let's say I had clients that had SQL 2014, SQL 2016, SQL 2022. And if I'm going to air quote test patches or test updates, then I have to basically maintain the expense of that entire lab. Okay. So now in the Wayback Machine, I used to be one of the senior security architects for a 13,000 user company. And a 13,000 user company did not have a test lab for that kind of stuff. Okay. So I don't know how many users exist in Delta, but what I can say is that their test lab cannot possibly emulate what would actually happen in a production environment. So whenever people are like, test lab, test lab, test lab, I'm telling you from my 30 years of experience in the technology industry and having been the person who deploys updates and deploys patches for almost that entire duration of time, the best testing is the testing that's done in production. And one of the things that WatchGuard brought to light when they talked about their process for testing, they do a lovely job of it where they have their test lab, but then they do kind of a slow roll deploy to the people who are going to best be able to handle the business interruption. Right? So it's kind of this like staged deployment. So it could be that Delta was doing something like that. But from like a CTO perspective and a strategy perspective, I think that the concept that says that they should be doing this kind of staged deployment, that's not even how I would address this. I would address it fundamentally at a much more core systemic concept of just simply saying, why would you take critical infrastructure and run it on an end user operating system? And that's my position on this, because Windows is inherently an operating system that, let's just take Patch Tuesday as an example. If I'm going to have an endpoint that's on the network, I need to make sure that that thing is patched, that the threat landscape or the threat surface of that computer is fairly reduced pretty substantially. So, in order to do that, if it's Patch Tuesday, and let's say there's a Chrome vulnerability and a Firefox vulnerability, and then there's a .NET framework update, and then there's a patch for the operating system, and then there's, you know, a cumulative update. I've now basically said there's X number of updates that I need to get all done in the same day. Now, in order to do that, I'm looking at what? 5 reboot windows. I swear, this is literally like, you have to have this patch reboot, this patch reboot, this patch reboot, this patch reboot. So literally, this is what actually happens in the Windows world when you have a Windows operating system. So let's say you are running your phone system on that Windows operating system. You're going to have your phone system down 5 times that day? I mean, this is bonkers. This is why you run your phone system on a Linux operating system. This is why your network layer security appliances don't run on Windows. You know, I personally do not think that you should ever run critical infrastructure on anything that is an end user operating system, which is fundamentally what Windows is. It is fundamentally something that it is not designed to have the kind of uptime that an AIX server or AS400 would have. And if I was the CTO of Delta, what I would be doing is I'd be saying, why on earth are we using Windows computers at the checkout stations, at the flight lines, you know, the lines that people walk up to and they want to talk to a, you know, flight boarding assistant, whatever their title is. Why do I want to use a Windows computer to project to the display in the airport what my boarding times are for anything? Why would I do that? I would absolutely not do that. I mean, if anything, what I would be doing is I'd either be running these people on Chromebooks, I'd be running everything off of an iPad to a website or to an app, or, you know, Android tablets to, you know, a website, you know. But fundamentally, what I'm talking about here is the backend system is something that can be accessed with an app or a website. Full stop. That's it. Webify the whole thing. And in the event that you're trying to project a display to these, like, you know, boarding displays, here's our boarding times, don't use Windows for that. Like, fundamentally, as soon as you say, I want to use Windows for that, you're now saying, I want to have a fairly substantial high total cost of ownership for something. And notice, I'm not anti-Windows on everything. What I'm saying is that Windows is a Swiss Army knife operating system, right? It can do your accounting. It can do your business critical software applications. You know, it can run desktop apps and do email and do web browsing, and you can shop on it. And you can, I mean, it's a Swiss Army knife operating system. So it's fantastic for an end user platform where you have a knowledge worker who needs to be able to do a whole bunch of things. What it is not a good fit for is an operating system where you need it to do this one thing. Because as soon as you say, I'm going to use a Windows operating system, now from a legally defensible perspective, now let's look at it from the insurance standpoint. Many of these companies had CrowdStrike exclusively just simply because of the fact that their insurance company said they had to have it. And then, so as soon as you have this Windows endpoint, you're having to fill out this answer on your insurance application that says, what's the percentage of your endpoints that have endpoint protection on, you know, that are covered by your endpoint protection platform? I would rather, as the CISO, I would prefer to be able to produce a report that says, these are our point of sale systems, and they're basically a bunch of Android tablets, and we have these in a mobile device management platform, and, you know, we have them locked down, whatever. Or I'd like to say, nope, we just have a bunch of Chromebooks, and this is what we use for it, and then we have the Chromebooks locked down, and blah, blah. I mean, I don't need to run an antivirus on a Chromebook, you know? I don't need to run an endpoint protection on a Chromebook. And I can put the Chromebooks all on their own little isolated VLAN, and I can make the Chromebooks only talk to the certain things that I want them to talk to, right? So you're talking about, I'm going to create a security zone profile that says, these are business critical functions. These are not the computers that people at headquarters are using to do, you know, email and accounting from, and whatnot, right? You don't try and take a knowledge worker like myself and stick them on a Chromebook. That's a recipe for like a fork in the eye, you know, but the Chromebook might be the right solution. Or I'd even go so far as to say, if I was the CTO, I would probably be using Raspberry Pis to run those displays of the flight times. Seriously, dead serious. It would probably be Ubuntu and a Raspberry Pi.
There you go.
You know,
so I think your perspective is absolutely spot on, because you're talking about, you and I discussed this before, you know, Windows being an end user operating system, it can do a lot of things. We're not trashing Windows here. What we are questioning is, you know, just the, what I had first called you about, how could this have been prevented? And I say testing, and you say Windows. How is this possible? So, you know, this is kind of where, you know, for everyone who's listening, the perspective that I get from Felicia is that, you know, when I am thinking one way, Felicia can absolutely say, Jeff, hold on to that thought for a moment, and let me explain to you where my experience and my knowledge base will show you that you, this in this simple process, and maybe it's not simple, I'm using that word loosely, utilizing a different operating system to do exactly what you were just saying would have prevented this meltdown of an airline. You know, other airlines have come back online. Other companies are back online. There are some fixes. There are some manual, there are manual requirements to get this back online. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Yeah. And I just want to add to something that you just talked about as well, which is that, so beyond the whole, we got to get back online piece, there's like two core things that you have to think about when you're going to select a technology and a strategy. And you're saying, what's my current total cost of ownership, right? What's my burden rate, my run rate for that solution? And then what's my red line case? So in this instance, the burden rate or total cost of ownership of a lot of these other technologies that I'm talking about, the burden rate or the total cost of ownership for just the running of that in those kind of tighter security zone profile use cases is a lot less than if Windows would have used. Certainly in the Redline case, it's a lot less, because what happens if your Raspberry Pi is a naughty biscuit? Well, I mean, I can tell you, I would have been able to go into the switch and just been like, shut down these ports and reboot the Raspberry Pi. You know, if you take the power away from a Raspberry Pi remotely, you can power cycle. It's the same as a wireless access point or a desk phone or whatever, right? So now you're talking about real economies of scale in that Redline case versus what these companies had to do in their Redline case. TCO was somebody had to physically manually do something to each individual busted computer. I mean, it was like Apocalypse Now.
Right.
You know, put it into safe mode and then do some manual stuff on it. So it was really one of two things. Either an IT person had to manually go visit every single computer and manually take action on it, or the IT person had to somehow support an end user doing that themselves. In both cases, this is apocalyptically expensive and not something that can just be done remotely. There is a very sweetness sometimes associated with something where you're looking at like a Google Chromebook, or you're maybe talking about an Apple iPad, or again, an Android tablet. In all of those cases, there is a factory reset option, right? So if poo-poo hits a fan, like this Redline case we're talking about, you could just tell the end user, factory reset that turkey, right? And then it talks to the MDM and it gets its new stuff and it does its little magical dance. And it, you know, like you could make an argument that theoretically you could use Windows Autopilot to do that, but not so much, right? It's like, again, Windows is a really, really powerful operating system. And one of the things that's powerful about it is that it'll run on a vast, diverse set of hardware versus like an Apple operating system is only going to run on this hardware, right? A Chrome OS is only going to run on a Chromebook, you know, like, and so those other things, those other devices, I kind of look at them as like the IoT stuff, right? The Internet of Things. And so it's like a desk phone where you have this like factory reset button. And so in the case where you're sending out a device where you need its recovery time period to be pretty short from a massive poo-poo hits the fan scenario, then again, Windows isn't exactly the right choice for that. We have an article that we provide to our customers as part of our knowledge base. And that article basically says, if you're looking to have business continuity for your core machine, right? Let's say you're an independent architect or an independent, you know, tax prepare or something like that. If you don't have two computers providing your own level of business continuity, then you shouldn't have any expectation that when something goes wrong with that one computer, that you're going to continue to be able to work. Because Windows doesn't have a factory reset button and like everything just magically starts working again.
Agreed. And this is kind of the hard lessons that everyone's learning. And from, you know, my initial thought was there was some sort of cyber attack, and you and I kind of laughed at that. And you're like, no, Jeff, this is an update. And, you know, and that's kind of what the world is looking at is, you know, how can something like this happen? But this is a prime example of a conversation you and I have had that technology drives revenue and profit. And without it, what will you have? So this is a, you know, whether this is the worst day of someone's career or life at, you know, CrowdStrike, because, you know, Boulder was not properly tested and a file was sent out to 9.5 million machines that disabled half the earth. I mean, Jesus, right? This is kind of one of those learning lessons of this is just an update. You know, we are battling cyber issues every single day. We see it every single day. And again, this was a mistake compared to what people could be facing, you know, in the upcoming years.
Yeah. So let's pivot to the whole counterparty risk thing, because I have to admit that I was over here, you know, like the cat that ate the bird, because I'm like, I told you so, everybody. You know, CrowdStrike, in my view, was never a trustworthy counterparty. And I would have never used CrowdStrike under any circumstances, because CrowdStrike was infamous for falsely certifying that it was a Russian hack of DNC computers that actually led to the leaking of emails and documents to WikiLeaks. Ooh. When in fact, it was actually Seth Rich who leaked the incriminating emails. Okay, so this is CrowdStrike. They said that. And then, okay, CrowdStrike was also guilty of falsely confirming conspiracy theories around Russian collusion around the, you know, two elections ago, right? Okay.
Right.
And then here's the creme de la creme of it is that CrowdStrike refused to give data to the FBI. And it's like, oh, get out of here with that. Like, so, I mean, CrowdStrike publicly, internationally, in two major, massive, high profile events, has fully discredited themselves as basically being a tool for the deep state. And it's like, no, I don't want that as a counterparty. I mean, I feel like as a business leader, as a business decision maker, there is so much of the covert economy and the covert risks that you have to attempt to manage that you have to be focused on that reality, because that's actually real, as opposed to the propaganda that exists in the overt economy, which for the most part is just nothing but mendacity after mendacity after mendacity, you know. And so you can't pay attention to those things and use those as your decision making pieces. And so when I see a company like CrowdStrike being completely obvious with, you know, what is at the core of their decision making practices and what they, you know, I mean, those two things basically revealed key pieces about their character and integrity and how they were going to make decisions. And so that flows down to everything. You know, that's like how you hire people. What's the culture of your company? What's the tone that you set? What do you prioritize? Are you prioritizing a meritocracy? Or are you creating a culture that tolerates mendacity and not only tolerates it, but actually promotes it systemically? So last 30 seconds is for you, Jeff.
Well, I'll tell you what, Felicia, it's an absolute pleasure every time we get to talk to you, being on your podcast. You know, we're learning something every day. And for everyone who's listening, you know, we all have to, no matter what your experience level is, no matter how you consider yourself as an expert on a certain subject, you know, we have to understand where our lane is. And my lane is this. It is straightforward. And when there is some sort of roadblock or I don't understand something, I know that Felicia King will answer the call, will guide me through any of my misconceptions, any of my misinformation, or at least certify or validate what I'm feeling towards any specific events. Felicia, having a relationship with you is invaluable, just absolutely priceless. And I appreciate answering all my questions.
Thank you much, Jeff.